you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Inversion of totalitarianism, as I've called it, is perhaps nowhere more strikingly displayed than in the fact, on the one hand, totalitarian regimes mobilize populations, regiment them, generally control them in some kind of unanimous goose-step. To put it very simply, totalitarianism seeks to mobilize populations. Inverted totalitarianism seeks to demobilize them.
That's Sheldon Wallen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Sheldon Wallen on inverted totalitarianism. Traditional totalitarianism conjures up images of jackbooted stormtroopers, gulags, and death camps. In recent years, a new variety of totalitarianism has emerged. Professor Sheldon Wallen calls it the inversion of totalitarianism. It represents the coming of age of corporate power and political demobilization of the citizenry. Unlike classical totalitarian systems, which openly boasted of their intentions to force their societies in a preconceived totality, inverted totalitarianism is not expressly conceptualized as an ideology, nor is it objectified in public policy. Corporations have de facto power and have, over the years, carried out a slow-motion coup d'etat. How to resist? Wallen says it starts at the local level. Our guest today is Sheldon Wallen. He was an award-winning scholar. Cornel West called him the greatest political theorist of and for democracy of our time. He taught at UC Berkeley and Princeton. He passed away in 2015. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Willits, California in 2003. And now, Sheldon Wallen, inverted totalitarianism.
Let me first talk about the notion itself by suggesting what I'm sure some of you are at least familiar with, and that is general features of totalitarianism. That is, what are we looking for when we talk about totalitarianism? First of all, and thinking basically about the example of Nazi Germany, but it applies to other totalitarian regimes as well, there's a dichotomy at the outset between elite and mass. The elite are regarded as in some respect specially endowed, such that their talents and skills make them natural leaders. The mass, in turn, indistinguishable from each other, largely the same, responsive to leadership and willing to follow, and mostly put on this earth to follow. Secondly, totalitarianism also is characterized by a one-party system in which one party dominates the political process and in the course of it eliminates or reduces to nullity the other parties. Thirdly, there's a strong ideology to totalitarian systems, that is a belief system that is coherent, that is palatable to large numbers, and that represents sort of the worldview, the sort of political substitute for religion in such a system. Next, regimes of this sort are characterized by control of mass communications. This is very closely related to the important role of propaganda within such regimes. That is, the attempt to, in fact, not only spread the party line, but make the party line the most preeminent of party lines. Next, there's the use of terror by such regimes. Now, it's important to remember that the Nazis didn't set about torturing and killing everybody. The important point was to instill a certain amount of fear, generalized fear, in a population, but not so deep-rooted or so deep-seated as to paralyze the population. In other words, it was to sort of be a vague presence, punctuated now and then by the fact that people would hear about cases of in which people were tortured or who were put in concentration camps or were generally disappeared, as we say, these days. Next, totalitarian regimes, particularly of the Nazi type, are expansionist. They tend not to remain contained within the boundaries of their system, but rather there's a certain dynamism that takes them outwards. But that's accompanied by treaty violations and a general tendency, particularly marked in the case of Germany, to launch wars on the flimsiest of pretexts, to invade a Poland, claiming Poland's going to attack Germany, invading Czechoslovakia because you claim that a German population in Czechoslovakia is being badly treated, and on and on. The Dutch are a threat, the Danes are a threat, the Scandinavians are a threat. So that the pretext on which foreign wars are fought are ones in which the regime takes the initiative and which, by most rational accounts, there's very little basis for their claims about it. Now, this is closely related to another matter, and that is totalitarian regimes are characterized by the subordination of domestic policy to foreign policy. Foreign policy and its demands financially, its demands in terms of manpower, its demands in terms of resources have the first precedence. And domestic policy tends to be put on the back burner, tends to be relegated to the point where it mostly takes the form of trying to prevent widespread discontent and why are rebellious or mutinous feelings among the populace. They are societies in which military virtues are exalted, in which heroism, manliness, willingness to die, willingness to sacrifice are not just virtues, they're preeminent virtues, exalted virtues. Now, turning from then this sort of general sketch, let me now try briefly to say what I mean by the inverted totalitarianism. What I mean by that is this, that a political system can approach or even imitate a totalitarian system without not only seeming not to be a totalitarian regime, but even professing to be the opposite of a totalitarian regime. Now, that's not an easy point to make, but it's going to be crucial, because if we take, for example, the question of elections, under the Nazis, elections were mostly staged, that is, managed, controlled, and in which the choices were very few, in fact, non-existent. So that elections really became plebiscites. That is, they became yes or no's, with the no's not even counted. In other words, elections could be manipulated, were manipulated, and consequently, the regime, nonetheless, could claim that they had popular support. Now, the question that makes this inverted, or if we put the question this way, can we say that we might get the same result in a political system, that is, where you get elections which are controlled or staged, and not necessarily, as in the Nazi plebiscites, 96 or 98% voting in favor of the regime, but a substantial portion of them, so that the outcome is one in which the system seems to be very difficult to alter, very difficult to change, even though there are apparently free elections. Now, we can take that one step further. We can say that while under the Nazis, propaganda was strictly under the state control. There were no independent newspapers or radio stations at the time. But then, as we know, it's possible for the media to become increasingly more consolidated, increasingly more homogenous, increasingly more uniform, and that the net result is that it becomes very difficult to enter counter opinions or to encourage dissident points of view. Now, to take another example, it brings us, I think, even a little bit closer. It's most scholars agree that the Nazi war machine really had no other purpose except to wage war. That is, the regime itself became increasingly empty in terms of any kind of goals or purposes or values other than war making. Now, this introduces a really significant point, I think, in terms if we think about the war on terrorism. Immediately after the September 11th disaster, the president said we could expect to have 20 or 30 years or more of a war on terrorism. In other words, it seemed to be endless. It seemed to be a kind of war at which, unlike other wars, where you enter into it thinking only of the point when you can have peace and return to normalcy, and where the end of the war is something that everybody is in favor of. But with the idea of a war against terrorism and the nature of terrorism, a kind of form of power which has no state, which has none of the ordinary accoutrements of government, which is shadowy and which appears to be never in the same place twice, yet appears to be all over, you have, of course, in a certain sense, a recipe for unending war, for war which goes on, and becomes, by that fact, a conditioning factor of your society. It becomes as much a part of your environment, so that when, for example, you take what used to be a simple thing, like a ride on a plane, becomes now tinged and edged by military paraphernalia around, by soldiers, by guards, by all kinds of equipment, all the other things we know. But what I'm trying to get at is simply the way in which war becomes an ingredient, a lasting ingredient of a culture, and in the process changes the cultures. Now, another interesting aspect of this is that while the Nazis, for their part, mobilized the entire economy, put it on a wartime footing, as we would say, and put the population on a wartime footing, and thereby reduced unemployment, inverted totalitarianism more or less lets the economy go into free fall, and despite rising unemployment, refuses to take any really significant measures. In other words, there's a certain element which an economy that produces in many ways an element of fear continuously, the kind of fear that comes, for example, not only from depression, but also from loss of jobs, downsizing, a rapidly changing market, which makes old skills and former skills outdated and anachronistic, so that the society again becomes something in which you don't want to cure unemployment. You don't want really to have full prosperity, because that takes away an edge from the society that's produced by the prevalence of fear, even if it's often unexpressed, even if it's often sublimated and repressed. When did I start thinking in this, what might seem to some as an extreme way? I think my starting point was that I don't believe the things I am talking about as inverted totalitarianism began with the Bush administration. It didn't begin yesterday or the day before. Now, that's by way of preface to something that occurred to me if you can take your memory back a bit, when our society and the rest of the world entered the new millennium. You recall the larger number of celebrations about the new millennium and how we're entering a new world and everything's going to be rather different. It struck me at the time that what was involved there was not simply looking forward, but forgetting. That is, forgetting what had happened in the previous century, the 20th century. Now, the 20th century, in many ways, was a terrible century. It's the century not only of two world wars, a spate of dictatorships in Italy, in Germany, and a quasi-dictatorship in Spain, and of course, the Stalinist regime in the Soviet Union. But it was also the time of Holocausts and gulags. It was the time of Korea and the Korean War, the time of Vietnam, and the killing fields of Cambodia. It's a century in which there is a lot of slaughter, a lot of destruction, and especially wreaked on civilian populations, not just soldiers dying in battle. The main thing about modern wars is that civilian casualties far, far outweigh military casualties. Now, in fighting these wars, the United States began to become a mobilized society because it had to defeat highly mobilized dictatorships, as in World War II. So the system, I think, began to change. For example, during World War II, there was universal conscription, there was wage and price controls, there was rationing of food and fuel, there was direction of the labor force, and of course, a great surge of patriotism, of nationalism, all in the name of national unity, which of course led at one point to the relocation of the Japanese Americans. Then as soon as World War II was over in 1945, without scarcely missing a beat, the United States proclaimed a Cold War against the Soviet Union. Now, at the same time, that something was happening, though, that was different. That was proven in the Cold War and proven again in Korea and proven again in Vietnam. And that was that you could fight wars of a certain kind without really bothering the population. Neither the Korean War, nor the Vietnam War, nor the Gulf War, nor any of those wars really imposed sacrifices on the population, unlike the German example, where the population suffered severely, where they were often short of food, short of fuel, short of housing, and so on and so forth. Now, in this period where these things, where this new development was taking place, there was also some changing views beginning in the Cold War era. Views about civil liberties, views about loyalty, views about patriotism, which found their way into loyalty tests and found their way into blacklists and in general produced something in American society which, except for the brief so-called Red Scare following World War I, really had very little precedent. Now, while this was going on, that is again contributing to the atmosphere of fear, even though it was often in the background rather than direct, was something that political and social scientists began to discover. They began to discover something about what they called the American voter. And they learned that the American voter was really, at best, a very anemic citizen, that they were uninterested, that he or she was uninterested in politics, that they were ignorant of politics, that they were unmotivated to vote. And sure enough, in the period following World War II, the actual percentage of voters who took part, active part in elections, began to slowly go down. Now, at the same time that this mass of uninterested, apolitical voters began to take shape, political and social scientists discovered something else. They discovered public opinion polls. Now, the juncture between those two things, that is, between an apathetic citizenry and the discovery or invention of polling meant, of course, that polls were being directed at an apathetic citizenry. And, of course, the polls, well, it was quickly learned, could be constructed. And along with that is you could devise the questions you wanted, that you could get, in a certain sense, the answers you wanted, that you, in other words, were creating through the polls a method of manipulation. It's always important to remember that voting research and polling began as market research. It began at the University of Michigan, where the Survey Research Center basically got into business by business, that is, conducting marketing surveys, so that the voter and the consumer became, again, almost interchangeable items. The result was, I think, the beginning of the development of what you could call a pseudo-democracy, that it was a democracy whose opinion was solicited, whose opinion was, it looked as though as their opinions were really wanted by the politicians and the leadership. But it was a democracy that, of course, existed within the confines of the polls. And the polls were usually of such a nature as to, for one reason or another, to edge out discontents, except when they were so widespread that they couldn't be ignored, but to also be very indifferent to minority opinions and be very indifferent to emerging protest movement. Now, the Vietnam War is interesting because it seemed to bring these proceedings to a halt. Not only was there widespread opposition to the war, but there was also, as we know, a stinging defeat for American power. But the war also, at the same time, reinforced this lesson that I mentioned a few moments ago, that you could have a very big war, lots of casualties, without really seeming to disturb people in their ordinary pursuits. The war was distant, it was remote, it was only brought to you by television, but your life wasn't really disrupted unless you were had the misfortune to have a member of your family in the draft. Now, this meant, this war, you could fight that war without really resorting very much to truly universal conscription. As we know, getting out of the draft was a major preoccupation of young people, young men, in this period. And that the end result was a military composed to a significant degree, out of proportion to their place in the population, of minorities, of racial minorities and cultural minorities, and also that it was a class army in an important degree. That is, the number of college graduates, the number of college students, the number of representatives of the upper middle class, and so on, were negligible. This was a war fought by the poor to a large degree and the minorities. What all of this meant, I think, is that warfare, as we know it, was beginning to dissociate democracy from its place in the system, that the system became geared in such a way that democracy was reduced to a relatively insignificant part. Now, this began to pick up pace as we move into our own century. There was an interesting comment which the New York Times carried when a New York Times reporter asking people about their opinion of the Bush foreign policy, Bush the second. And she explained her support for that policy by saying, after all, I'm quoting from her, after all, we are an empire. Now, the fact that empire and superpower are becoming part of the common political vocabulary signifies, I think, that important changes are really taking place and have been taking place. We can see how something is amiss if we simply try to combine the word superpower with democracy. Who ever heard of a superpower democracy? Who ever heard of an imperial democracy? The combination sounds, as they say in philosophy, oxymoronic. That is, they don't fit together. They're opposed, and they shouldn't be in the same tandem. As I've said before, those words indicate, I think, again, an important systemic change, and changes have been taking place. Let me outline some of those changes with an eye towards trying to suggest how they fit into a more or less of a inverted totalitarianism. First, the presidency. Wars, and even these kind of wars that I've been talking about, expand presidential power. We know that from as recently as Vietnam, where Congress did what it did with the war against Saddam Hussein. That is, they virtually gave the president a blank check. Now, it's well to recall the words of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln said at one point that no one man should hold the power of taking the nation into war. And that's virtually, of course, what we have done. Now, this has been accompanied, of course, by the weakening of the legislative branch, the branch which traditionally was supposed to be closest to the people. And what has happened here is that representative institutions have been short-circuited. They've been short-circuited by the new array of lobbyists, by the new array of pressure groups, by the infusion of vast amounts of money. The result is that representatives, senators, and members of the House are more beholden to those people than they are to their constituents. So that in that contest between president and legislature, it's sort of no contest. That the weakening of one is accompanied by the strengthening of the other. Now, equally important, if not more important, is something else that I think has been less publicized. And that is the transformation of the party system. We're supposed to have, according to the textbooks, a two-party system. And in a two-party system, the function of one party is to govern. The function of the other party is to serve as an opposition party. And serving as an opposition party means offering an alternative that's more or less clear, that stands in significant opposition to the other party. Now, what I'm about to say, I don't mean to discourage any of Republicans among you, but I do want to say that the Republican Party, in the really since the Reagan administration, has transformed American politics. They've transformed it systematically by organizing a strong and significant ideology, by systematically developing not only party organization, but also developing support groups of various kinds. There are numerous young Republican groups. There are numerous groups named after the Federalists or named after James Madison and so on. In other words, it's a new phenomenon in America because the Republicans, unlike the Democrats, not only can govern on the basis of a fairly coherent ideology that's systematic, but they also, unlike the Democrats, they are a good, in quotation marks, opposition party. When they are in opposition, they oppose. Now, whatever you might think of that opposition, it at least preserves the idea of an alternative. But on the other hand, what has also happened, the Democrats have gravitated towards the center. And the so-called left of the Democratic Party is, except at election time, inconsequential. Now, that means that in effect, the Democrats have conceded that the one major important development in the last 40 years or so, and that is the Republican Party has won over the country to a basically conservative ideology. Now, I'm not trying to say that critically. I'm trying to state it as a fact. It is a more conservative society, and we owe it almost entirely to the efforts of the Republican Party and like-minded conservative groups, religious groups of a similar kind. Now, the result is that as a result of the Republicans being a gung-ho party and the Democrats being feckless, is that you virtually have a one-party system, even when the Democrats are in office. I mean, Bill Clinton was a centrist, and the centrist said, we are going to be fiscally responsible and conservative on financial matters. There's little to separate the Democrats from the Republicans. As a result, there's no significant opposition party, which, as we pointed out before, is related to the character of a totalitarian system. Then there's that equally